Good morning, New Mexico, and welcome to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. We're broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company on Cordova Road and streaming on the web at ksfr.org. We're also podcasting at the website santafe.radiocafe.org, where you can listen to the show anytime you want to, thanks to Santa Fe's Dotfoil computer services, and you can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. I'd like now to welcome journalists Jeremy Scahill and Dar Jamal. Jeremy Scahill is the author of the book Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army, published by Nation Books, which is in the process at this point of being translated into 13 different languages. He's an award-winning investigative journalist who writes for The Nation and is a correspondent for Democracy Now!, among many other outlets. And Dar Jamal is with us. He is an independent journalist who spent 8 months in occupied Iraq between 2003 and 2005. And he's the author of the new book, Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq, published by Haymarket Books. And he writes for Interpress Service, Reports for Democracy Now!, and once again, many other news outlets internationally. Welcome, gentlemen.
Good to be with you.
Thank you.
Great to have you here. Jeremy Scahill, Dar Jamal, and artist Sia Armajani will be speaking tonight at 6 o'clock at the Greer Garson Theater on the campus of the College of Santa Fe in an event for the Santa Fe Art Institute entitled Fallujah, Revealing War, with a discussion moderated by yours truly afterwards. And it follows the opening from 4 to 6 of Sia Armajani's monumental sculpture Fallujah at the Santa Fe Art Institute. Dar, let's start with your book, since it's just coming out. It's actually, the publication date is next month, but there will be some copies tonight available for our lucky listeners and visitors. You went to Iraq for the first time in the fall of 2003 because of your dissatisfaction with U.S. media coverage before and during the invasion of and occupation of Iraq. And there you found that you were one of the few American journalists who wasn't embedded with the military. How did you start going about your work of reporting on Iraq?
Well, I basically had found a couple of contacts offline en route to Iraq. I managed to hook up with my first interpreter by running into a filmmaker, James Longley, when he was on his way out of Iraq, and he hooked me up with his interpreter since he was going out of the country for a bit. And so I managed to get into Iraq, get into a hotel where there were a lot of other foreign journalists from working independently and a few other American independent journalists, and we basically were all on a shoestring, and so we teamed up and started working on the ground together, sharing drivers, sharing interpreters. Of course, at that time in Iraq, we could all stay in an unguarded hotel. There weren't kidnappings, there weren't beheadings and things like this, so we had pretty free access. I was taking taxis by myself, going around. We were able to go around together in cars, which of course today either of those would be unheard of. But I started posting, I basically started by sending emails back to friends back home. I had no intention of working as a journalist. I had no intention of ever returning to Iraq again. I just had 130 emails of friends back home that wanted to see what I was seeing. And so every night I would send them back the emails. And I did that for about 2 weeks. And then someone suggested I started posting on a website called electronicirock.net. And I did that for a few weeks, and then off of that website, I started to actually get asked to do some radio stories for BBC, write for a website called New Standard News, and then at that point, I realized, oh, I might be able to come back and start working as a journalist, and so that's how it all started.
So you paint a picture of Iraq which is really dire. It's horrifying. It's a military occupation that appears to be really a conscious campaign of cruelty and humiliation and just gratuitous violence. As you put it, power without accountability. You see people being beaten, detained, killed, pillaged in their homes, in their mosques, even school children being detained, being taken away from their families for throwing rocks. I mean, tell us some of these stories.
All of the horrors that we've seen coming out of Iraq for the last couple of years, whether we're talking about Abu Ghraib or the Hadithas or going on down the line, pick an atrocity, I saw evidence of all of these within my first 4 or 5 weeks in Iraq. I mean, I was in Iraq 72 hours and I was already hearing stories of torture, not just in Abu Ghraib, but in U.S. military detention facilities all over the country. One of the things that I ran into about 2.5 weeks into my first trip was when Saddam Hussein was captured on December 13, 2003. And the day after that, I just happened to be over in the Amariya area of Baghdad, which is where the infamous bomb shelter is, which was bombed by U.S. warplanes during the 1991 Gulf War and incinerated 400 people, mostly women and children. So we were there seeing the tomb, which is now a memorial of that. And then on our way back to Baghdad, we passed a secondary school, and it was completely sealed off by the U.S. military, and it was just me, an interpreter, and a Hungarian videographer, and we decided, hey, let's go see what the heck's going on here. And so we walk up to the school, and I started talking to soldiers, and the first couple wouldn't talk to me, and then I finally ran into one that said, oh, well, there were some kids here having a pro-Saddam demonstration yesterday, and so some Iraqi police took photos of them, so now we're back to get the kids. And they literally had gone into the school with their weapons and pulled out 16 kids that they had photographs of from the previous day and took them and detained them from anywhere from just a few hours to one kid was held for 24 hours. And then when they started to...
For their young political beliefs.
Because what they did is they basically, as an act of being classic high school kids, right, is they torn pictures of Saddam Hussein from their textbooks and were jumping around holding them basically because the teachers told them not to do that. And so they, yeah, basically for doing that, which here would be classified as cutting up in school. And so they were detained, taken to a nearby U.S. military base, some held for 24 hours in chicken wire outside. And when they were pulling away from the school, it was one of those moments that struck me early on in my time in Iraq, was as the military vehicles were pulling away, some of the kids started throwing rocks at them. And then at that point, one of the soldiers started laying down suppression fire over all of our heads. We were all in a crowd together, and he started shooting, and people were running for cover. And these are high school kids throwing rocks at tanks. And so that was really one of my first impressions of this is what the occupation is going to be like.
There are also many instances of American soldiers raiding mosques, and one of them you even had your interpreter happened to be actually there praying at a mosque when the Americans came in.
Right. This happened in November 2004. It was roughly in the time frame of the second U.S. military assault on Fallujah. And it was a Friday, which was always our day off. It's the day of prayer in Iraq. And my interpreter had gone to his mosque, as he usually does, and then was going to spend time with his family. So I was sitting in an internet cafe just getting caught up on some writing and relaxing a little bit. And I got a phone call, and I saw it was from him, which I thought was odd because I knew it was the time he's usually in his mosque. And he said, Dar, I could hear screaming in the background and gunfire. And he said, Dar, I'm in my mosque. It's being raided by American and Iraqi troops. I'll call you back. And so I sat there stunned. I didn't know what to do. And so I decided, well, I should start writing all this down. So I wrote down the time and exactly what he was telling me. And about that time, he calls back and he says, they've killed at least three people. We're laying on our stomachs. We can't do anything. And he said, I have to be very, very careful. I'll call you back if I can. And then the phone goes dead again. So I just am writing it all down. And it turns out that he did eventually get released because they started releasing families a couple of hours into it. And he managed to escape by a small child grabbing his hand and pretending like he was his father. And so they managed to get out. And then my interpreter called me from home and gave me the rest of the story. And it turned out that they had killed at least four worshipers, wounded several others, and then detained 30 others while they were in the mosque praying. And it was another one of those events that really just underscored the brutality and the ruthlessness of the occupation and sending a very clear message to the Iraqi people that this has nothing to do with democracy and freedom.
What does it have to do with?
I think there's three main purposes for the invasion and occupation. There's oil, of course, Iraq having the second largest oil reserves on the planet, geostrategic positioning of the U.S. military in Iraq, and then absolutely without a doubt it worked in favor of the interest of some of the extreme right-wing elements in the Israeli government.
But how does going into a mosque, humiliating and killing innocent people at their time of worship, really further our ends? I mean, that's one of the things that's so stunning about hearing the actual stories of what's going on. It doesn't obviously win hearts, minds, allies, or anything else.
It's hard to say for me, is this part of a deep, dark plan that we're just going to basically go in and rape and pillage the country, or are we going to do this to intentionally instigate violence against us so that we can not have peace here and justify a continuance of the occupation? And, you know, because from the very beginning of the occupation, from when Bremer disbanded the military to you know, pick one classic massive mess up after another, not getting engaged in the reconstruction projects immediately, not having elections sooner than they did. I mean, each of these hugely critical mistakes. And it really, you know, I don't know how they could have done it much worse, because I would argue that had they started, pushed to have elections a bit sooner than they did and have real legitimate elections, and had they engaged in one third of the reconstruction projects that they had made promises to the Iraqi people they would do, I would argue that the situation would look quite different today than it does. But instead we have this hellish situation where over 1 million Iraqis have been killed. There's over 4 million refugees, and according to the latest Oxfam report in July, there's 8 million Iraqis, one third of the total population of the country, are in dire need of emergency assistance, meaning if they don't get medical aid and attention, food, drinkable water, then they're in really, really bad shape. And that's one third the population of the country, on top of 4 million refugees and 1 million dead.
We're talking to independent journalist Dar Jamal. People need all this emergency aid, and yet another thing that you saw over and over again was the deliberate targeting of hospitals, doctors, and ambulances.
This was another thing that I had seen evidence of this before I went into Fallujah during the April 2004 siege, which was kicked off by the or at least the reason used to justify that siege was the four Blackwater USA mercenaries being killed and the brutality carried out on their bodies on March 31. But then within days of that, the siege was launched on April 4th, and I went into Fallujah during a so-called ceasefire, according to the U.S. military. It was April 9th. I knew it would be dangerous, but I managed to get on a bus carrying humanitarian supplies into the city. Excuse me. And so I decided to go that day. I figured, well, you know, a ceasefire, it's going to be better than other days, obviously. But when we were going into the city, we were watching F-16s dropping bombs in the middle of the city, helicopters strafing other parts of the city, fighting was all around, and the U.S. basically did not have control. We went through one American checkpoint on the way to the city, and all the rest of the checkpoints were Mujahideen checkpoints. But we got into this small clinic where we brought our medical supplies, and out parked right out in front of the clinic was an ambulance with a small grouping of gunshots right on the driver's side of the windshield. And the driver was actually there. His head was bandaged because he had been grazed by one of those shots. And there were several other bullet holes in parts of the ambulance. And this one was still operable, although it had been shot up. And there were several other ambulances that had been taken completely out of commission. And what the doctors at the clinic told me, and the ambulance drivers specifically, said, we're being attacked by snipers. We can't use our ambulances. Even when doctors try to go out on foot, we're being shot at by the military. I later interviewed an Iraqi doctor also working in Fallujah at the time, and he said, when all our ambulances were shot up, we would go out on foot and try to help rescue people, and literally at one point they had an old man on a stretcher, and to get him across the street, they had to run across the street, hoping not to be shot by snipers, throw a piece of rope across the street, have someone tie it to the stretcher, and then pull that across. So clearly a very, very deliberate campaign of targeting anything that moved.
Well, not only anything that moved, but doctors and ambulances that were clearly marked. I saw one of the pictures in your book, and it wasn't like it said the word ambulance in Arabic. It had the word in English.
Right, because the majority of the ambulances that I saw in Fallujah were donated from other countries, donated from places like Spain and other European countries. And so, yes, clearly marked ambulances. And even the Iraqi Red Crescent ambulances, they have the red crescent on there. It looks like the stereotypical ambulance. I mean, there's no mistaking ambulances working, even though they're in a war zone, or doctors who are wearing white coats or blue coats, and very clearly doctors not carrying a weapon. You know, it's very, very clear. There's absolutely no mistaking. Just like the hospitals in Fallujah that were bombed by the U.S. military, they had big red crosses painted on the tops of them. There's no reason whatsoever to think that these were mistakes.
Another thing that contributes to the many health problems in Iraq is the lack of potable water and the lack of infrastructure, including electricity and heat. That means that people are building whatever kind of fires, using whatever kind of fuel they can, inside their houses, which leads to a huge increase in the rate of burns.
Right, and this was one of the first stories I saw when I arrived in Iraq back in November 2003. I went to Saddam. It was called Saddam Medical City, and it's the largest medical complex in the country, right in the middle of Baghdad. And I went to, the Italians actually had set up a burn unit there, because they're already at that point in November 2003, there was far, far less electricity than there was before the invasion. And so what that was causing was a huge uptick in the amount of fuel people were using to stay warm. So people were burning open kerosene and in other ways in their homes of trying to stay warm. And so, as you said, that amounted to a massive increase in the amount of burn injuries, where kids would bump into a stove and tump it over, or accidents like this. And when I interviewed the Italian in charge of that burn unit at the time, he said there had been a 300% increase in the amount of burn victims. And that's exactly what I saw in that clinic, was little kids, elderly, sometimes women that had massive third-degree burns over large portions of their bodies. So this is one of the ways the U.S. corporations, like the Bechtels, for not doing their job, they're fulfilling their contractual obligations of reconstructing, doing rehabilitation projects, water treatment. Even early on, I was seeing evidence of cholera outbreaks, dysentery, diarrhea, nausea, kidney stones, even in the capital of Baghdad as far back as December 2003. These were huge, huge problems. And of course, since that time, Bechtel, who withdrew from Iraq last November, being paid $2.3 billion worth of contracts, much of their work was never even started. And as you said earlier, power without accountability. The same goes for the contractors. There was just no accountability in Iraq, and there's none today.
You actually reported on Bechtel's progress in fixing water treatment systems.
I did. I went down. I got hired by a group out of Washington, D.C. called Public Citizen, and they gave me a copy of Bechtel's initial $680 million no bid cost plus fixed fee contract, and said, go to these water treatment plants and figure out which ones are basically what the status is. Are the Iraqi people getting what they were promised? And first of all, the contract was interesting because it was very vague. It was really difficult to find specific areas that were mentioned where work was going to be done, let alone completion dates for the projects. But I did find four. One was in Baghdad, the Sharqiya water treatment plant. I tried to go there, but I wasn't allowed entry by the U.S. military. So I went to the other three that I could find, which were all south of Baghdad, Hilla, Najaf, and Diwaniya. And I went to each city, I went to each water treatment plant in each city, and I interviewed either the head or the assistant engineer at each treatment plant to ask them, what are you seeing? Because one of them had already passed the completion date for the contract of Bechtel, and the other two were very near it, so I expected to at least see some work. And what I saw, the best case scenario was, at one of those water treatment plants, one of the engineers said, well, some subcontractors from Bechtel came, they replaced our sand filters, but that didn't actually do anything to increase the amount of potable water available to people in our service area. The other two cities where I interviewed the engineers, they basically said, Bechtel who? And how that translated on the ground at the time, and this is in January 2004, was that there were entire villages with no source of water whatsoever. That literally, there was one where women were having to take mules with flasks on them and travel half a mile away to a stream that only ran in the winter and get water and bring it back to the village. Of course, this water is not potable water. Another village, there were eight children that had died crossing a nearby highway to a factory across the way that would sometimes give them drinkable water to bring back to the village. Everywhere I went, there was rampant complaints of diarrhea, nausea, kidney stones, these types of things. And then that trend, of course, has...
Including in the hospitals.
I actually interviewed doctors and even administrators of hospitals that talked about the fact that just clean water, so they could practice safe sterilization for surgeries and treating patients, was just not available. I interviewed the head administrator of Shuadar Hospital in Sadr City, This is an area of 3 million people. This is the largest hospital in the area. And on the record, that administrator told me that they had 15% the amount of water that they had to do their job. And as far as supplies, he admitted to me on the record that they were having to reuse IV needles because they did not have enough, and they had to choose between either risking infection or risking losing a patient. So he said, well, of course we have to risk infection, even though we know this is strictly forbidden. That was back in June 2004. And then, again, citing the Oxfam report that just came out, that report states that at least 70% of the Iraqi people do not have access to clean drinking water. And this is another trend that continues to worsen.
We're talking to independent journalist Dar Jamal. His new book, which is being published next month, is called Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq, with a foreword by Amy Goodman. The focus in the mainstream corporate media is on sectarian violence, and your book paints quite a different picture in which Sunnis and Shia and everybody else are basically united in their resistance to the U.S. occupation. Tell us what you saw, and this is actually a question for both you and Jeremy Scahill.
Well, the unity between Shia and Sunni, I reported on that a lot. It's changed a lot since my last trip into Iraq, but what I saw even up until the January 2005 elections was that, first of all, when you go up in Iraq and you ask someone, are you Sunni or are you Shia, the most common reaction I got was, I'm a Muslim and I'm an Iraqi. They just didn't refer to themselves that way. It'd be about the equivalent of a foreigner coming to the United States and walking down the street and going up to someone, well, are you a Baptist or are you a Catholic? I mean, they'd get a quizzical look of, you know, that's just not what we do here. Well, it's the same in Iraq. Other times I would ask people and they would say, well, my mother's Shia and my dad's Sunni. Can you tell which half of me is Shia and which half of me is Sunni? My point is that there wasn't this distinction being made. There was, while there are differences, of course, between Shia and Sunni, and oftentimes they would pray at different mosques, there were mixed neighborhoods in Baghdad, mixed cities, of course. There was never this segregation that we're seeing now. But early on in the occupation, for example, one of my friends, a religious Friday speaker at a mosque in Bakuba, said that 2 weeks into the occupation, U.S. military commanders came into Bakuba and said, okay, we were going to have a meeting next week between tribal leaders. We want all the tribal leaders and religious leaders to come. And when they all showed up at that meeting, the U.S. military commander in charge split them up and said, okay, we want the Shia on this side of the room and the Sunni on this side of the room. And his point was that early on, there was clearly a divide and conquer type of strategy being implemented. You look at how the IGC, the Iraqi Governing Council, was set up, strictly along sectarian and ethnic lines, again, doing nothing but promoting schisms and infighting and power grabs between all the different groups in Iraq, rather than unity and real democracy. And then, of course, this trend carried on into the January 2005 elections. But another point, and actually I think Jeremy should talk on this too, because some of this is in his book, but there was the thing I'll end with is pointing out that as a result of the failed November 2004 siege of Fallujah, there had actually was already in place the workings for death squads to be operated in Iraq and facilitated in large part by the U.S. Talking of this, we can point towards John Negroponte being the U.S. ambassador in Iraq around that time frame. And under him was a man named a retired Colonel James Steele, whose title was Counselor for Iraqi Security Affairs. And these two men had previously worked together in Central America in the 80s. Negroponte was Reagan's ambassador to Honduras from 81 to 85. Colonel James Steele worked down there, and together they were instrumental in setting up and facilitating the right-wing death squads, which killed tens of thousands. Well, that policy was implemented in Iraq during the winter of 2004 and early 2005, and this led Secretary of Defense Donald Rumsfeld in January 2005 to be quoted in Newsweek magazine as contemplating using the Salvador option in Iraq. Well, that was already being used as a response to the failed siege of Fallujah. They set up the death squads, operating them out of the Ministry of Interior, and sent them out to target the leadership of the Sunni resistance and sympathizers with the Sunni resistance. So that set in motion this massive problem of the death squads, which today, when we talk about civil war in Iraq, it's more death squad on death squad activity. It's not that, well, I'm a Sunni and my neighbor Shia, so I'm just going to go kill them because of that, or vice versa, but it's death squads and various militia groups that are going after each other on the basis of sectarianism.
We're talking to Dar Jamal, and Jeremy Scahill is with us. Any comments?
Yeah, well, I mean, first of all, we should remember that the so-called Petraeus report is going to be coming out imminently, and of course, General Petraeus and Ryan Crocker, the current U.S. ambassador, are going to be appearing before the Congress today, and of course, you remember that we can hardly call it the Petraeus report because we understand that much of the report has been written actually by the White House political operatives. The Los Angeles Times broke that story. I actually want to go back to something that was a much broader question asked early on about the point of the invasion of Iraq and the question of oil. I think that there are sort of two agendas at play here, and this does relate also to the Salvador option. What I see in Iraq is a very classic application of what the United States has systematically done to Latin America going back to the 1950s, where you had a dual application of economic shock policies, economic neoliberalism started by Milton Friedman and the so-called Chicago Boys, and then the actual application of torture on those that dared to resist the neoliberal economic policies. In Iraq right now, the two agendas are that the neoconservatives approached Iraq hoping to make it the freest market in the world. They viewed the Arab world as the last unconquered territory. Asia was well under the control of the U.S. influence. Russia had now turned into a neoliberal state. Latin America had been rampaged by economic neoliberalism. But so many of the states of the Arab world, the economy was in the state's hands. And so the point of going into Iraq, I take them at their word, was to essentially blank Iraq clean. And to build it up as this model, and the idea was that it would spread from through Syria and Lebanon, and ultimately to Kuwait and Saudi Arabia. 90% of Saudi Arabia's economy is under the control of the kingdom, and it's only helpful to the United States insofar as they don't want to have to deal with the problem of attacks against U.S. troops in Saudi Arabia. And so the United States has gotten into bed with the royal family, and that agenda in Iraq has been an absolute failure. Paul Bremer went in and implemented these disastrous policies. De-bathification sent a quarter of a million Iraqi soldiers into the resistance that the U.S. could have very easily co-opted at the beginning stages of it. They had this intention to pay for the sort of program in Iraq with Iraq's oil revenues. They've yet to seize Iraq's oil, and it's because of this massive resistance. And what we see in Iraq right now is what we've seen in Latin America. Those that resist are tortured. Those that resist are abducted. For every one person that you torture or abduct, the word gets back to their community, and that's shock. And that's how you maintain this organized chaos in Iraq. But that agenda has been a failure because of a fact that no one wants to talk about. The U.S. military, the mightiest in history, is being militarily defeated by a disparate group of resistance fighters who are also killing themselves while at the same time defeating the most mighty empire in history. But the broader agenda here has been an unmistakable success, and that is to push forward with a corporatist government model. There are 630 companies on the U.S. government payroll in Iraq right now. There are 180 mercenary companies. Billions upon billions of U.S. taxpayer dollars have gone into the coffers of these politically connected war companies, and their intent is not just to profit off of Iraq. In fact, some of them are probably actually losing money in Iraq. They have a much broader picture here. They are building up companies whose economies dwarf that of some nation states, whose manpower, firepower, military power is greater than many of the world's militaries. And so what actually has been the enormous success that almost never gets talked about is that they have been able to take this period of utter chaos and war and bloodshed and turn it into an unbelievable opportunity to push forward this corporatist neoliberal agenda globally, to the point now where the very existence of the nation state is being called into question by the rise of these companies funded with U.S. taxpayer dollars because of the war in Iraq.
Jeremy Scahill is with us. You've written this book called Blackwater, which many of our listeners have heard of, and many of them probably even read. But as you say, it's only one of many military contractors active in Iraq, and it's not even the largest by any means. How are they viewed by the Iraqi people, the contractors in Iraq? Do they see them as more U.S. soldiers? Do they see them as distinct?
Yeah, I think, and especially this comes from talking to former contractors. One of the things that happened after I wrote this book, and I think anytime you write a book of this nature where you dig into a company, people come out of the woodwork and start talking to you. Most Iraqis think that these guys who run around with their half-shaven faces and their wraparound sunglasses and wearing so-called civilian clothes, they believe that they're CIA. Many Iraqis believe that they're Mossad. In fact, we have a lot of evidence to indicate that when those four Blackwater men were killed in Fallujah, that the Iraqi group that killed them, that had ambushed them, actually believed that they were ambushing Central Intelligence Agency operatives. And so for Iraqis, I think it's all the occupation. I think most Iraqis are probably unaware of the fact that there are so-called private contractors or mercenaries. They view the entire operation as a mercenary operation. And one of the, on a sort of pragmatic level, if an Iraqi gets killed by a private contractor, and this has happened, and then they go to the U.S. military and they say, you know, my father was driving this taxi on such and such street in Baghdad, and they go to the military and the military looks into it and they say, well, we didn't have any troops in the area, and then they dig into it a little bit further and, oh, it turns out that it was Company X. There's no recourse. There's no way for them to have any kind of compensation for what those mercenaries have taken from them, which in many cases is their life. And we have contractors, as they're called, mercenaries, running around Iraq, just firing at Iraqi vehicles left and right, engaging in firefights. And then Eric Prince, the head of Blackwater, says, oh, well, we only engage in defensive operations. You can't get more offensive than occupying someone else's country. Anytime an Iraqi shoots at a Blackwater vehicle, is that an offensive operation on the part of the Iraqis, or is it a defensive operation on the part of the Iraqis? I mean, who's offensive and who's defensive here? The mercenaries want to say, we're only doing security in Iraq. No, it's complete garbage. Blackwater has placed its forces, along with 180 other mercenary companies, at the vanguard of the U.S. occupation.
I think one of the things that's very strong about Dar Jamal's book, Beyond the Green Zone, is that it puts one so close to the human beings, the Iraqis, who are living there, that one can't help but feel, what would it be like if my town or my city in the United States were occupied? You give us the ability to empathize with the people who are living there, going about their business, having their lives destroyed, and you realize that the Iraqi people are probably handling that a whole lot better than we would.
Well, they really are, and it's one of these things that, you know, when, especially earlier on in the occupation, when I would come back from Iraq and people would ask me, well, you know, why is there so much violence? Why are they fighting against the troops? The troops just came in there to do good. And, you know, this is, of course, just a product and a result of the propaganda campaign from the Bush administration and propagated by the corporate media, where, like, this invasion actually had something to do with bringing liberation to the Iraqi people and improving their lives and bringing freedom and democracy. And it just doesn't take a whole lot of imagination to think, like, well, pretend like our country was invaded by a foreign occupation force and now we're being occupied and my neighbor has been detained and we're hearing these horrible stories coming out of these occupation detention facilities of torture and horrible things being done. I'm watching cars being shot up on the street by people running around not even wearing soldier uniforms, as Jeremy spoke of. And so what am I going to do? Well, eventually I'm going to have to resist and try to kick these people out of my country, and at the very least, probably pick up a weapon to safeguard myself from them. And that's exactly what's happening in Iraq. And I can't tell you how many Iraqis I've spoken with that have spoken of the very thing that Jeremy mentioned, of these security, so-called security personnel. I prefer to call them mercenaries, because that's what they actually are, riding around in these unmarked cars that stand out like sore thumbs. They're typically either very large black or white with tinted windows, Suburbans with armor and usually a tail gun, or someone sitting in the back with a machine gun hanging out of it, racing through the streets, driving on sidewalks, shooting at any car that might get a little bit too close to them, sometimes shooting at cars just because they feel like it. And, you know, what message does that send the Iraqi people? Is that send a message, well, let's sit back, let's give them a little bit more time to try to bring things under control in our country? Or does that send a message that we better take up arms and try to protect ourselves?
And Iraq, though it's supposedly a sovereign nation, is not allowed to prosecute anybody, basically, because of the Paul Bremer's coalition provisional authority rules. Are those still in place?
Yeah, the rule that you're referring to, I mean, I call them edicts issued by Paul Bremer. I mean, he himself said in his memoir that he was only the second ruler that Iraqis had ever known. That gives you a sense of how he viewed himself. I mean, they called him the proconsul or the viceroy of Iraq, and he issued this series of edicts like an emperor. In Order 17, granted sweeping immunity to all contractors operating in Iraq from prosecution in Iraqi courts. And one of the most contentious examples of a lack of prosecution of contractors stemmed from an incident involving a Blackwater contractor on Christmas Eve, this past Christmas Eve, inside of the heavily fortified Green Zone. An off-duty Blackwater contractor who allegedly had been drinking got into some kind of an altercation with a bodyguard for the Shiite vice president of Iraq, Abdel Mahdi, and allegedly shot and killed him. And Blackwater says it was ordered by the U.S. government to remove that individual from Iraq so that the Iraqis would not capture him and prosecute him. And so this contractor was whisked out of Iraq. Blackwater admits that it did that. They say they were ordered to do that by the U.S. He's not been prosecuted. He's not been charged with any crime. And it just came out a couple of weeks ago that Abdel Adel Mahdi is very clear with the U.S. Embassy that it was a murder, and he has been keeping it under wraps so that it doesn't get out in Iraq that this happened. And he said, in according to a State Department memo back to Condoleezza Rice, that if Iraqis found out about this, none of them would understand how it is that an American could murder a bodyguard for the Iraqi vice president and nothing would happen to them. So this is causing tension between Iraq and Baghdad. But there have been 64 courts martial of U.S. soldiers on murder-related charges in Iraq alone. That's a shockingly low number. I mean, it's pathetic. 64 courts martial. There hasn't been a single prosecution of an armed mercenary for any crime. Not for crossing the street against the light, not for stealing, not for looting, not for corruption, not for murder, not for torture. And so either you have tens of thousands of Boy Scouts running around Iraq working as mercenaries, or the Democrats are systematically failing. I mean, people talk about this as Bush's war, it's Rove's war, but no, this is Nancy Pelosi's war. This is Harry Reid's war. Joe Biden says, well, we can't cut off the funding, so we need to continue funding it. It defies logic. And all of the major so-called viable Democratic candidates, their plans, or lack thereof, will have the exact same occupation going well into their administrations. None of them have forcefully come out and come up with anything. Some of them seem to have no understanding of Iraqi history. If you believe the Iraq War began in March of 2003, you're probably driving around with a Hillary or Obama bumper sticker on your car. This has been a policy going back to the 1950s, when the United States supported the rise of the Ba'ath Party, when they gave lists of communists and dissidents, all the way through the Gulf War, the sanctions, Clinton's bombing campaign against Iraq, the Democratic failure to stand up and hold real hearings in advance of the Iraq War, and now the continued support for the occupation.
And as you, Dar Jamal, point out in your book, the Iraqis are used to resisting. More than 8 decades ago, they resisted the British.
Right, exactly. I mean, the historical parallels are quite outstanding. I mean, just using Fallujah as an example, when the British were occupying Iraq during the 1920s, they met with stiff resistance in Fallujah, and so they sent in a British commander named Colonel Leachman into the city to try to figure out the situation, and he was promptly killed by resistance groups in Fallujah. And ironically, he was actually killed by a man who is the great grandson of the man who's now the individual in charge of the Sunni Association of Muslim Scholars, Harith al-Dari. And so, and then Fallujah, chemical weapons were dropped on it by the British. There was bombing raids carried out in the city by the British, same thing that was repeated by the Americans. And then now, again, drawing another historical parallel, look what's happened within the last 2 weeks down in Basra. The British are pulling out. They're continuing to lower the number of troops they have. Patrick Coburn, the excellent foreign correspondent for The Independent in the UK, has written just last week, this is probably the most dismal, humiliating military loss the British have suffered in decades. I would maybe even compare it to as big of a humiliation as their pullout in the 1920s and 30s from Iraq. Well, the same thing's happening now as they are being forced out. U.S. troops are going to be forced into a situation where they're going to have to deploy now in the south, and then they're going to get mortared every single day in sustaining the attacks that the Brits have from the massive Shia militias that are down there fighting for power as well. So the historical parallels are we're watching history repeat itself right now.
You were continually asked why the U.S. was calling Iraqi resistance fighters terrorists, quote-unquote, when they really saw us as the terrorists. You make a very strong case for the many, many ways in which the U.S. has created a resistance, which they call an insurgency, and yet what we hear coming out of the media, which seem to be straight from the White House, is that the resistance is Al-Qaeda.
Well, right. There, you know, as Jeremy pointed out earlier, that there was actually before we right before we went on air, that there was the only al-Qaeda that were in Iraq before the U.S. invasion was launched in March 2003 were in northern Iraq. It was the Ansar al-Islam groups up in the Kurdish-controlled north, which were actually safeguarded by the U.S. military. And the U.S. did have this information. There was no al-Qaeda presence anywhere to be found outside of the Kurdish-controlled north. But when the U.S. occupation began, and to this day, there's been little to no border control whatsoever by the U.S. military. Of course, any foreigner that wanted to could come into Iraq. I mean, I went in the first time in November 2003. This is 7 months after the fall of Baghdad, and there was no border control whatsoever. I mean, I went in. None of my bags were checked. My car wasn't checked.
And there was no U.S. military in sight.
I did not see one soldier on the border coming in on the main highway from Amman. So to this day, basically, anyone wanting to go in and take up arms coming in from Saudi Arabia, Jordan, etc., can go in and launch attacks against the U.S. military. And there are al-Qaeda in Iraq now, thanks to the U.S. invasion and occupation and the total lack of security and the extreme levels of chaos that have engulfed the country.
You know, and on this issue of who's the terrorist, etc., there's been all of this news lately that there's this great success happening in Al-Anbar province, which is where Fallujah is in the west of Iraq, a predominantly Sunni historically area of the country. And what they're saying, even last night I was watching CNN, and they repeat the U.S. line. These Sunni tribes that the U.S. is funding and arming are in a partnership with the U.S. because they want to defeat the foreign fighters in Al-Qaeda in Al-Anbar province. Well, I have a colleague who just got back from spending six weeks unembedded in Iraq, traveling around and talking to all of these resistance groups. And he said very clearly, those Sunni tribes are not fighting anyone who even vaguely resembles al-Qaeda. They're using it to go in and slaughter their Shiite enemies. And a U.S. Spokesperson told my colleague that they're freedom fighters, these Sunnis. And this is part of the classic death squad operation that the U.S. has been running there. Initially, they were funding Shiite militias that were operating under the auspices of the Iraqi Interior Ministry. Now they've shifted back to their old allies from the Ba'ath Party and from the Sunni community, and they're using it so that they just blow each other up, that they kill each other, and that the chaos continues. But he was very clear. They're not fighting al-Qaeda. The al-Qaeda numbers probably are in the low thousands, if that, in Iraq right now. It's a total ruse. I mean, it's a paper tiger. It's false.
And yet, the U.S. media appear to be essentially a propaganda machine for the White House.
Right. Well, I mean, my friend who and I know Dar hasn't been there in a while. I haven't been there in a while. But my friend who literally just got back 2 weeks ago from Iraq said that he didn't see any Western journalists whatsoever in 6 weeks of traveling unembedded around Iraq. He said they're all just caged in the green zone. And he was actually saying,
including European?
Yeah, including European. I mean, he was saying that the closest he got to Europeans was you know, Turkish journalists. And the you know, the interesting thing is he was saying it's not as dangerous as the media is making it out to be. All these cowards hiding around in the green zone. He said, you just have to be willing to talk to actual Iraqis and figure your way around. I mean, we haven't seen any abductions lately of journalists. And he was saying that there's been a distinct shift now, that Iraqi groups are actually wanting people to be there and to cover it. And they're all hiding out, camped out inside the green zone, getting fat, eating the Burger King Whoppers. And you know, these guys go around. They're not being protected by armed mercenaries. And they found they went all over Iraq. And the point I'm making here is not to say, oh, they're so great. My point I'm making here is it's laziness. It's systematic laziness on the part of the media. Arab media workers have died in the scores since the U.S. invasion of Iraq began. And because of them, we know so many of the crimes. We need Western journalists also to be willing to go outside of the green zone and talk to actual Iraqis who aren't their translator, aren't their taxi driver, and aren't making their whoppers.
Another point about the media that you make in your book, Dar Jamal, is that the U.S. propaganda machine is really, or has been, trying to be quite active in Iraq. Tell us the story of Ismail Zayar.
Ismail Zayar was a man that I interviewed. He had headed up a newspaper called the Al Sabah, and at first, when he was running this newspaper, of course, he was excited. He believed some of the rhetoric coming out from the administration that yes, there's going to be freedom and democracy and a free press, and you know, not a state-controlled press like you had under Saddam Hussein. And so he took that
at face value, and he started his own newspaper called the Al-Sabah. And it quickly turned out, I mean, they were writing about what was happening during the occupation, and this is around summer of 2004. And he was then promptly visited by various individuals from the Coalition Provisional Authority, as well as a couple of different U.S. generals, who basically said, why don't you cover stories like this? And were basically trying to hand him certain stories that they wanted him to cover that were basically direct U.S. military propaganda. And he ended up refusing to do so, and was essentially threatened by the CPA that, well, your funding's going to be cut if you don't start doing this. And so he saw the writing on the wall, and so he left and started out Al-Sabah al-Jadid, his own new newspaper, and left that basically and told me point blank. He said, look, I'm a journalist, I'm a newsman, I'm not going to allow myself or the people working at my newspaper to be used by the U.S. military to do their own propaganda. They already do that. They do a good enough job on their own. They don't need us running their articles as well. And so he struck out on his own and started his own newspaper without CPA funding.
And then they tried to assassinate him.
And then they did. It's unclear if it was them directly. These things are generally hard to prove, but when you look at who benefits in the historical context of the situation, not that long after he went out and started his newspaper, which is where he was when I interviewed him, he had been running it for less than a couple of months when one of his bodyguard, actually some armed men showed up at the newspaper office, and they went in to, they asked to speak with him. They said, hey, look, the minister, I think it was the Minister of Information, if I remember correctly, wants to have a word with you. And he knew the minister, and so he said, just a second, I'll be right with you. He went upstairs and he called the guy, and the guy said, no, I have no reason to talk to you. And so he escaped. The men immediately detained one of his bodyguards and took him off, and then they found him a day later shot in the head. So a very clear message being sent to Iraqi or all Arab journalists, for that matter, of this is what is going to await you if you try to strike out on your own and report independently.
Jeremy Scahill, in 1992, Dick Cheney, as defense secretary, led the movement to privatize the military under the elder George Bush. And 6 years ago today, September 10th, 2001, defense secretary Donald Rumsfeld gave a speech railing against the Pentagon bureaucracy and encouraging privatization. So what activities are now privatized as a result of the campaigns by these two defense secretaries to privatize various aspects of the military?
Well, I mean, first of all, I think most Americans or most people in the U.S. are still totally unaware of this. There are now more private personnel operating on the U.S. government payroll in Iraq than there are soldiers. This is an incredible development in U.S. military history, where you have 180,000 so-called private contractors just on the U.S. government payroll. This doesn't count the private personnel working for other governments. It doesn't count the private personnel working for other companies. There are 180,000 on the U.S. government payroll, 165,000 U.S. troops, 630 companies. So what we've seen is an entirely privatized operation where the actual active duty military becomes the junior partner in a coalition of what is essentially a coalition of billing corporations. So and what's different from when Cheney initially gave Halliburton the contract to write a market for its own self, and that's what he did. It was one of his last acts as defense secretary in the early 90s. At the time, the contractors were just doing food, laundry, driving trucks. Now they've outsourced a significant portion of the actual combat function of the war, and that's what's different about it. And now we see
and
that
intelligence gathering.
Well, I mean that's like a whole other show. But 70% of the U.S. intelligence budget now goes to private contractors. I mean, we're in the midst of the most radical privatization agenda in the history of the country. In intelligence, you have and Blackwater's at the vanguard of this. They have their own private intelligence company being run by 30-year veterans of the CIA called Total Intelligence Solutions. Aegis, a company headed by an infamous mercenary named Tim Spicer, is running a huge intelligence operation inside of Iraq. This is the next frontier, privatized intelligence. We think it's scary that Bush is doing wireless wiretapping. What about when a private company starts doing it? We have some semblance in theory of accountability over government activities, although less and less every day. What about when it's a private company? And now, relevant to this part of the country, the border issue. DynCorp, which is a massive Texas mercenary company, is itching to get its men on the border as border guards. Blackwater's been deeply involved with this too. It's everywhere. Schools, hospitals, military, law enforcement, prisons. It's on. They're winning.
Jeremy Scahill and Dar Jamal. Unfortunately, it's time to go. The hour has flown by. It's great to have you. Thank you so much for being with us at this early time in the Santa Fe Radio Cafe.
Thanks for having
us.
And I would like to repeat, Jeremy Scahill is the author of the book Blackwater, The Rise of the World's Most Powerful Mercenary Army, published by Nation Books. And Dar Jamal is an independent journalist whose book is called Beyond the Green Zone, Dispatches from an Unembedded Journalist in Occupied Iraq, published by Haymarket Books. Both of those books will be available tonight at the event called Fallujah Revealing War at 6 o'clock at the Santa Fe Art at the Greer Garson Theater, which is right after an opening from 4 to 6 of Sia Armajani's monumental sculpture Fallujah at the Santa Fe Art Institute. Sia Armajani will also be speaking tomorrow night at 6 o'clock at Tipton Hall and will be giving a masterclass tomorrow morning starting at about 10 o'clock at the Santa Fe Art Institute. For more information, you can call Santa Fe Art Institute at 424-5050. I think that's all. You've been listening to the Santa Fe Radio Cafe. My name is Mary Charlotte. KSFR streams live on the web at ksfr.org. You can email me at radiocafe@ksfr.org or leave a message at 428-1528. We're also podcasting at santaferadiocafe.org, where you can hear the show anytime you want to. Thanks to Santa Fe's wonderful dot foil computer services. You can also subscribe to the show on iTunes. Thanks to Marilyn LeBlanc for engineering today. Stay tuned for the BBC, followed by local news by KSFR's award-winning news team, and after that, The Colors of Jazz. Broadcasting live from the Santa Fe Baking Company, my name is Mary Charlotte. We'll see you tomorrow. We'll be talking about global warming tomorrow. Ciao.